It's 30 years since Sinead O'Connor went on the iconic US TV show Saturday Night Live and sang the Bob Marley song War a cappella and then tore up a picture of the Pope. For the American audience watching the broadcast, it came across as an act of war. A life ban on NBC followed, as did a hate campaign on the media across America and in person, with performances greeted with choruses of boos. This provocative political action is the pivotal scene in Nothing Compares, a documentary on Sinead O'Connor. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by the director of Nothing Compares, Catherine Ferguson. And before we get into the documentary itself, Catherine, when did you first come across the music of Sinead O'Connor? Where were you and what kind of effect did it have on you at the time?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a long-winded story, so I'll try and keep it brief. But really, I was introduced to The Lion and the Cobra through my father, Sean, in Belfast in the 1987 when it came out, when I was very young. And it really became the soundtrack to my childhood. My father, luckily, thought she was the bee's knees and played her on repeat as we were driving around many a rainy car journey around Belfast during that whole time. And it just became this very visceral soundtrack to my childhood. But then it was in the early 90s when I was in my early teens that really my friends and I really discovered her, you know, in her own right, and could really see her and hear her. Obviously loved the music anyway, but could really see what she was all about. And we just hugely admired her and were so excited by her as this icon for us as these young teenagers.
And what was she saying in her songs? Yes, as you said, the music, let's put that to the one side. The voice speaks for itself. But what was she saying lyrically that really connected with you as a young teen at that time?
I don't even know if it was the lyrics. It was the sound that came out of her. I think it was, it's cliche and everyone's talked about it, but the whisper to the scream. And I think it was hearing that really deep rage that just bellowed out of her, I think, was very exciting to us as young women. To hear that from one of our own particularly was really exciting. And I think it was that more than particularly what was said in the songs. And of course, lots was said, but it was the sound, I think, which I think actually a lot of people would say beyond anything, it's that they really emotionally connect to.
When it came to the making of the film, then, you know, you decide you're going to do something about Sinead O'Connor. You narrow it down and you narrow it down to a very specific time period. How did you choose the time period and why did you want that? I'm saying narrow, but why did you want that particular frame, that particular focus?
Sure. Well, from the very beginning, we'd always planned to keep it very focused at 1987 to 1993, really for multiple reasons. A key one, I suppose, is that, Sinead has had such an amazingly full life, and to be able to do her life story justice. I mean, I take my hat off to anyone that can get that into a 90-minute film without it being a very thinly spread top highlights piece of work. That's one reason. But actually, I suppose the key reason was that we wanted to lay the foundations in many ways and to be able to look at the cause and effect. Because, you know, as you say, one of the key scenes, we reach in the film is when we get to Saturday Night Live and the ripping of the Pope. And I think that action just left a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of people confused by why she did that. And I suppose a lot of the film that we've made is trying to go right back to the beginning to be able to look at the cause and effect and to why she did that and to make sense of it. Because I think once you can do that, then everything post-1993 makes a lot of sense.
There's archival footage that we see and hear, and there's also a contemporary interview with Sinead O'Connor, which it has her in some ways reflecting back on what happened at that particular time. Was it difficult to get that current interview?
Well, it was, I mean, again, it's a bit of a long-winded story, but, you know, Sinead and I have a history in that, well, I can tell you quickly, but as I just going back to the teenage years, you know, the reason that I honestly think the sods for the film were sown was in the 90s when my friends and I saw what happened next with Sinead, when we witnessed, you know, this icon of ours being treated as she was. It was very demoralising to us as young Irish women to witness this happen. And I honestly feel like that's when this all started. So then in 2011, I was doing a master's at the Royal College of Art, and I made a film called Mather, obviously Irish for mother. And it was starting to look much more visual, deconstruction, a lot of the themes that are in the film around Catholicism and Ireland's treatment of its women. And I'd reached out to her then manager to ask if I could please get access to the stems of her music, because I wanted to deconstruct them for this experimental short. So that's where the first contact was made, way back in 2011. They thankfully granted the use of the stems, and then they came back to me in 2013 and asked me to direct Fourth and Vine, which was a single that came out then. So that's when I got to meet her and the team around her. And all that did was stoke the fires further, I think, in me, you know, as this filmmaker, you know, a young filmmaker. It just reminded me of everything I'd felt as a teenager and why she'd been so important to me. And that's really when it all began.
And interesting that Maher and Mother was the name of that short, that experimental short, because when very early on in the documentary, in your film Nothing Compares, we get Sinead speaking about her childhood and her memories of that particular time with her mother. They're very difficult to listen to.
Oh, yes. And I think, you know, Sinead spoke about it very honestly in her book, you know, that came out in June 2021. It's a really sad, sad story. But I think, I suppose what we were trying to do in the film, as Sinead says herself, is to look back at the transgenerational trauma in Ireland. And she says really beautifully in one of the clips, you know, she obviously suffered under her mother, but what had happened to her mother and her mother and her mother before her. And I think that's a key theme in the film, is looking at this transgenerational trauma that's so embedded in all of us.
And obviously we get very much Sinead's memories, and her memories of very difficult things that went on and treatment that she had in her family. Did you speak to any other family members? Was that important? And why did you not do that? Because some of their sides might have been different from hers.
I suppose we just didn't in any way plan to try to, you know, involve any family members at all. We wanted to tell the film that we set out to do, and we just... We just didn't want to go down that.
The Saturday Night Live is the centrepiece of the film. There's no question about that. But you lead up to it via the childhood trauma, and then into it starts, in fact, in New Jersey. Yeah. Starts in New Jersey when she refuses to when she says, "Oh, I don't want any national anthem." Before, and she's had a huge success with Nothing Compares to You at this stage. She's a big star. Everybody loves her. She can't do any wrong. Then she does that. She won't have the national anthem, the American national anthem, before her concert. Was that the beginning of the real trouble, do you think?
I really think it is, from looking back through lots and hours and hours of footage, that really seems to be when the tide starts to turn, particularly in America, and certainly with the press. So by the time we get to Saturday Night Live, I feel like they're waiting for her. You know, it's been building over the 2 years prior because of...
And a couple of things have happened. So there's several interviews, in fact, with Gay Byrne that appear throughout this footage. They are in footage from those interviews in the film, in your film. But we also get sometimes Sinead commenting as well in contemporary chat. And here we have Sinead now, first of all, and then it's after the National Anthem event, and she's talking. This is just a little snippet from the trailer. She's talking with Gay Byrne about what happened that night.
Everybody in music has a story in terms of what they went through.
Every person's duty to themselves is to act on their feelings and to say when they think something is wrong.
And take the consequences.
I imagine so.
Now, that's just a little snippet. It's quite a long clip of it in the film itself, Catherine Ferguson. That's from Catherine Ferguson in front of me this evening, speaking about her new documentary, Nothing Compares, all about Sinead O'Connor. She's well capable of handling herself when she's challenged. He goes on to ask her about, you know, did you think about giving back the money? And she puts him in his place.
She does. She does.
And she does that in several interviews, never with aggression, though.
No, and I think it's fascinating when you see these interviews play out and just what she was having to contend with in terms of the interviewers, you know, it was certainly a very different time and the tone. I think they just didn't really know what to do with her. So the tone's always relatively mocking and condescending across the board.
Yeah.
Across the board in America, here, everywhere, you know. And I think she does manage to answer with a lot of grace and is incredibly quietly spoken and very clear on her views.
And this is a young woman in her 20s at the time.
Very young woman.
Incredibly articulate, incredibly well able to handle any of these, feel the questions. Not just feel them, she doesn't bat them off into place. She meets them face on the nose and answers them. However, then we get the Bob Dylan anniversary concert and Chris Christopherson introduces her. Let's just have a listen to what happens. Now, this is after Saturday Night Live. The problem has happened. The picture of the Pope has been torn up after singing War. And then she goes out to this reception in the Bob Dylan concert.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
And that booing stroke cheering that's going on there as Sinead O'Connor comes onto the stage, introduced by Chris Christopherson for that 40th anniversary concert of Bob Dylan. She's standing there looking at this huge, Madison Square Gardens, wasn't it? It packed.
20,000 people.
A mixture of booing and cheering. Yeah. It really is both.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary moment.
Well, it really is. And I just think it's such a critical piece of footage to include because you can see the excitement on Sinead's face as she walks out to this crowd, because here she is being asked to essentially sing at the birthday party of one of her musical gods. And the reception is fairly horrific as she arrives on stage. And I just think it's very profound because you can see everything crossing her face in that footage and what she's having to consider. And she obviously makes a very bold choice. Instead of skulking off away from it, she deals with it head on. It's very powerful.
She pulls the earphones from her ears.
She does.
Where she'd be getting talk back or whatever. And she sings War again.
She does.
With the Bob Marley song. There's your answer to that. Let's have a listen to her publicist who went into her straight after the Saturday Night Live event, went in backstage to her and spoke to her. Elaine Shock is the name of the publicist.
She blows the candle out. She goes off stage. I had gone into the dressing room after her and I said, you know, I can't get you out of this. And she said, you know what? I don't want you to.
If I acted at the time in the way that I felt would be most true to myself.
Again, a little less section from the trailer for Nothing Compares, and the director of the film, Catherine Ferguson, with me in studio this evening. We're only scraping the surface, really, Catherine, but when you spoke to Sinead O'Connor today, did she have anything new to say about that particular time or her attitude towards it?
Well, I just think within our interview, she's amazingly reflective looking back on this period. I mean, I suppose it's a real conversation starter now looking back at what happened 30 years on. I mean, it's very shocking, I think, even to contemporary audiences when they see what she went through. What I love, you know, within the interview is just how much she stands by what she did, and she has zero regrets about her actions within that. And she even goes on to say that the proudest thing she's ever done. And I just love that that's her contemporary take on it.
And then she also goes on to say, well, I understand why they thought I was crazy, but I was right eventually.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of what she was talking about came to pass. Thanks for coming in to speak with us this evening, Catherine. And I'm going to finish with a little bit of Mandinka again from the trailer, and a very important line that comes towards the end of your film, which will speak for itself.
I wasn't thinking to myself, I must be strong. I didn't know I was strong. An artist's job is sometimes to create the difficult conversations that need to be had. That's what art is for.
Sinead O'Connor. I am a woman. I have something to offer.
They tried to bury me. They didn't realise I was a seed.
Clip there from Nothing Compares, the Catherine Ferguson documentary that we've been speaking about with the director, and that film opens nationwide this weekend. We will be reviewing it on Thursday night's programme. Now, just one look at the TV listings and we can see that we are obsessed with cookery shows. Rick Stein, Jamie Oliver, The Hairy Bikers, The Great British Bake Off, and the list goes on and on. All prove that as a spectator sport, at least, we just love a succulent sauce or a non-soggy pastry bottom. So it's not surprising that a drama about the trials and tribulations of a young gourmet chef toiling in his family's sandwich bar has filled audiences with anticipation. Audiences including our TV reviewer, Jen Gannon. Jen, you've been waiting, starving, unsatiated hunger for The Bear to arrive on our screens. Why and what is it?
For the longest time, we just thought we were never going to get it because it just came with a bang on American screens in June, and the reviews across the board were 5 out of 5 and you couldn't get any better. And there was just so much hype surrounding it that it kept on building over the summertime and we never knew when it was going to happen. They got it in Australia, I think, in August, and we were like, when is it going to happen? Is it ever going to happen? But it's finally here. Yeah. On Disney Plus, and it dropped tomorrow, be tomorrow. And for people who might not spend every waking hour waiting for its arrival, it's a dramedy and it's created by Christopher Storer, who directed the kind of dark dramedy Rami. And then also Joanna Callow, she was involved with Hacks. She's a co-creator as well. And that would give you the hint of the kind of tone of things. Yeah. So it's about a young chef.
Yeah, this the chef, Carmen is his name.
Burzado.
Yeah.
The Bear himself.
And Shameless star Jeremy Allen White playing the title. He is a prestigious Michelin star. Mm. That's where he has worked, in Michelin star restaurants up to now. Now he's in the family sandwich shop.
Yeah.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
Exactly. In one way. So he's returned to his hometown of Chicago after his older brother, much beloved brother in the community, Michael, kills himself. And Carmi had this meteoric, obviously, rise to fame. As you're saying, he's working in these Michelin star restaurants. And then his brother, who wouldn't let him work in the restaurant when he was alive, this is a bone of contention, actually surprisingly leaves him the restaurant in his will. And so he feels like he has to take over this ailing local Italian spot. And this is his vocation now. And this is where his focus is. And it's like one of those, you know, those genre pieces where it's a homecoming, but it's an uncomfortable homecoming. You can never go back to the place where you once were from. You've changed. Everybody else has changed. Yeah. And he is an outsider now to his family and friends.
However, we do get flashbacks to his time in the Michelin star restaurant, where the head chef, he was under the tutelage of a head chef played by Joe McHale.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to that particular kitchen. And yeah, these kitchens are Gordon Ramsay kitchens.
Industrial language, let's put it that way.
Industrial language is polite. They never stop.
No.
So be warned, from the very start, they're shouting at each other and using foul language. So here he is, Carmen, played by Jeremy Allen White, learning his trade under the tutelage of head chef Joe McHale.
Chefs, table 38, 2 people. Table 23, 4 people.
Broken sauce, chef. Need a new one.
Yes, chef.
Fire 31, 25, 2 out on 31, chefs.
Still not there again, chef.
Yes, chef.
Thank you, chef.
Wait on 31, Hi. Chefs.
Hey! Why?
Chef, I'm sorry, it got too hot.
Why?
It didn't cool down.
Why?
But it was my fault.
Go.
Fine.
Fire 19, chefs.
Hey!
Hold on 17, chefs.
Hey! Why do you hire idiots? Do you like working with idiots?
I'll do better.
Say yes, chef.
Yes, chef. Can you not handle this?
Is it too much for you? Answer me.
I
can handle it, chef.
I can handle it, chef.
12, 10, 36.
Fire, 8,
don't
13,
fuck with my
36,
town.
Sorry,
3,
chef. 8,
52,
13,
14.
29, chef.
Why are you serving broken sauces? Why? I get it. You have a short man's complex. You can barely reach over this table, right? Is this why you have the tattoos and your cool little scars and you go out and you take your smoke breaks? It's fun, isn't it? But here's the thing. You're terrible at this. You're no good at it. Go faster. Keep going faster. Why are you so slow? Why are you so fucking slow? Why? You think you're so tough? Yeah. Why don't you say this? Say, yes, chef, I'm so tough.
Yes, chef, I'm so tough.
Say, yes, chef, I'm so tough.
Yes, chef, I'm so tough.
You are not tough. You are bullshit. You are talentless. Sing hands.
Hands!
You should be dead.
Not for the faint-hearted, it would seem, a life in chefing. Certainly under the tutelage of Joe McHale, the head chef in the Michelin kitchen where Carmy, Jeremy Allen White, started his restauranting life. And that's a clip from The Bear, which is coming to Disney Plus from tomorrow. Jen Gannon has been looking at it. So it kind of sounds like a mix of this, looking back on that particular period in his life, Jen, and then the current family story with the death of the close family member. Is one or other of those to the fore, or are there other storylines going on?
There are other storylines going on behind the scenes, because, I mean, really it is Carmy's story, like he is the bear, as we said. And, you know, it is about him kind of returning home and wanting to stake his claim and be this chef and be respected in his hometown and be respected by his family and kind of get his life back together. But it's not just about him. It also takes in the actual staff that work with him and work alongside him in the kitchen. And they're also, they're given their own kind of shining performances in it, and they're given their own storylines as it does go on. And it's an amazing supporting cast. I think the one that probably everybody will be talking about is his cousin Richie, who's played by, if you remember in Girls, Ebon Moss-Bachrach, I think his name is. He was Marnie's troubadour husband in Girls.
And he's a fairly tough cookie in this, isn't he?
He is. He's one of those obnoxious, ultra-masculine, tracksuit-wearing guys who loves to, like, just cut Carmy down at every corner. And he's going through a divorce, so it's about his kind of breakdown as well. But also the fact that he likes to lord over Carmy, the relationship that he had with his brother Michael, and that Carmy didn't have the same kind of relationship with him. But he gets all the best lines. I mean, from that clip, it sounds very serious. It sounds like Full Metal Jacket in a kitchen, and it kind of is, but then there's also just this dark, dark streak of humour to
it. Yeah, I think there's maybe more of a sense of that when we hear this is the staff, and Richie, the cousin, is in the midst of this, and the character of Sydney.
Sydney is this new recruit, so she comes to the restaurant and asks Carmy, basically, can I work here, because she admires his work and hears that he's back in town and is dying to work alongside him, and she's really ambitious. She's played by Ayo Edebiri, who's a comedian by trade, but she's getting into acting, and it's a wonderful performance by her in this.
So we'll hear her in the midst of this clip. We'll also hear Richie in the midst of this clip, the cousin, and Jeremy Allen White as Carmy. And this is a point where the staff of a sandwich shop are not taking too well to the new Michelin rules that Carmy wants to instigate. And once again, it is a Gordon Ramsay kitchen, and there's plenty of language being flung around the place.
Ibra, make sandwiches. Don't stop making sandwiches.
Yes, chef.
I'm going to make three sections, okay? They're going to be wet, hot, and sweet, all right? I'm going to take green tape, make those sections. Louis, yes, I want you to get the sandwiches, put them in the corresponding sections. Poppy,
okay,
come on. Yo, sweet, bag, Sharpie, label that shit, please, chef.
Yes, chef.
Martina, fire every single chicken we have, please, okay? Yes, Richie, chef. Do you even know how to do fries?
Yes, I know we need them now.
Okay, Marcus, where are we on cakes?
Get in there.
Getting there. Marcus, what the fuck are you doing still working on this shit?
Yo, come on, what are you tripping for?
Come on, what am I tripping for? Are you here right now?
It doesn't make a difference.
There's four cakes and still
left. Yeah, I was going to cut them.
They're not even cut yet?
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal.
Chef!
I'm doing them in five, basically. I'm going to order them in five.
Stop, everything. Fire everything right now.
Okay, I'll fire everything now. I just was finishing talking to Marcus.
Step out.
Okay, I'm going to talk to Marcus.
Get the fuck off my expo, chef, now! Thank you. We're firing 76 beefs, 34 chickens, okay? 12 french fries, 12 mash, now.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Behind. Corner. You didn't say corner.
You didn't say corner, so don't blame me. That's a clip there from The Bear, the new series on Disney Plus that Jen Gannon is speaking with us about this evening. Head chef Carmy, played by Jeremy Allen White, in the midst of that. Richie, the cousin, played by Ebon Moss-Bachrach, and Ayo Edebiri as Sydney, the kind of the young commie chef.
The acolyte almost, like Carmy's, yeah.
But you know, even that, I don't know what, the minute and a half, that, or a minute and 20 seconds that clip is. I watched the first episode, the very short episodes, they're 28 minutes.
Yeah, around half an hour long, And like, it's almost like the BBC financial drama industry, if you've watched that. There's no time to adjust at all. You're thrown into this world immediately from the get-go and you have to adapt, you have to go along with it. So you're picking at the backstory from the clues that are given. You're learning the lingo, like you heard there, corner, back, yes chef, all of that, and hands, really important one. And you're understanding, you get to understand everyone's place in this kind of travelling circus, and there is no hand-holding. You feel like it's, you know, your first day on the
it's
job.
It's intense in that respect,
it
isn't
it? And I know people have been comparing it to like the kind of being Scorsese-esque, because it is a lot of there's a lot of masculinity in it. There's a lot about knockabout humour, that there's underlying implications to this humour, but and there's a, it's gritty and very authentic. But I also, for me, I think when you're watching it, it's beautifully done. It has a lot of quick cuts and edits. It has this gorgeous kind of nicotine stained yellow flush to it, and a cold blue to it. And it reminds me of, you know, Aaron Brockovich era Steven Soderbergh more than anybody. I think it's very in debt to him, and it has that intensity and rawness to it too.
Yeah, and it ought, I've mentioned Gordon Ramsay a couple of times because of the language right across the series, or certainly the bits of it that I saw, and Gordon Ramsay's kitchen nightmares, you know, the idea where he goes into the kitchen that's in a mess and he gets it sorted
he's
out.
He's trying to save them. But the thing about the bear is everyone is an idiot sandwich, including Carmi. You know, he doesn't know everything either. He's not, you know, this fearless leader either. He's trying to work it out. He's trying to understand his brother through this restaurant. He's trying to understand, why did his brother leave him the restaurant? Why did his brother leave him in astronomical debt as well? His brother is kind of a mystery to him, and he's trying to solve this as well as trying to keep everybody afloat.
Yeah, and do we start to get in the episodes that you've seen, get to the heart of what the problems are in the sandwich shop?
You do, as in, like,
and
I
you probably don't want to give too much of it away.
I don't want to give too much away, but it is about kind of, you know, that internal, when, you know, the entire staff, they would rather keep that status quo. They'd rather keep the workplace the way it is. They don't want to change, and they definitely don't want him to tell them what to do. But then as it develops, you can see there's this great character, Marcus, who wants to learn to be a pastry chef, and he kind of gets into it and blossoms under like Carmi's tutelage. So you can see them forming together as a team, and when they start to work together, you're almost cheering from the sidelines, like you're, you know, watching a Premiership football match. Like, that's how engrossed you get into it. That's how enthralling it really is. And you don't really get to the bottom of who or why, the who's and the whys. There's no comfort in it. It's not about the home life. You don't get to go back to their home and try and understand where the motivations for anything really. It's not, there's no romance story in it either. It's about work, and it's about redemption through work, and how important work is to working class people, and what it means, how to escape your background into something else like a Michelin star restaurant, or how to make yourself better and improve your life through work.
But I want to again go back to the Gordon Ramsay thing and the kitchen nightmares. How confrontational is this series? Because I must say that the 28 minutes that I watched of that first episode, I thought, jeepers, how will these people ever speak to each other again? Because it is quite, it's in your face in that respect.
And I think a lot of people find that, whether they find it very, a lot of reviews saying it was hard to watch, but it's hard to watch in the way that...
Yeah, I think Rolling Stone in particular were fairly harsh on it, weren't they?
But like, I think it's hard to watch in the way that Succession is hard to watch, or Industry is hard to watch. It's a real, it's rapid, it's, but also something like Hacks. Hacks is hard to watch sometimes too, because it's cringy, but it's also like, it's visceral, and you can't escape from it. You feel like you're stuck in that environment and sweating for those minutes. And because some of the episodes take place in real time, the second last episode, called Review, is astonishing, and it is one of the best half hours of TV I've seen this year. It's along the lines of the Stephen Graham film Boiling Point, about working as
a
chef.
I was thinking about that.
Very like that. Yeah. And it's
although it didn't have quite the pace that this has. It's a very different pace than the Stephen Graham film.
There's a lot of workplace hazing, there's a lot of disgruntled opposition, and that can be very nerve wracking to watch. But I do think at the end of it, you get something from it.
How many episodes? Something. How many episodes
There's
in total?
Eight episodes.
And you've watched all eight of this.
Eight. Yeah. And I'd watch them again and again.
You'll come back for second helpings.
Exactly. And there will be a second season. So I think a lot of people are glad that we're getting another slice of it, for sure.
All right. So it's a big plus from you, with all of the, despite all that confrontational and aspect of it.
Yeah, I do. I think like it's enough. There's enough there, and there's enough humour to balance that kind of destructiveness out to make it work.
All right.
And to make it enjoyable.
Make it work and make it enjoyable is what Jen Gannon is saying of The Bear, which is available on Disney Plus from today. Yes, from today. The Irish Cultural Centre in Paris, Centre Culturel Irlandais, celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, and on September the 16th they held a little celebration for the anniversary of its founding. Producer Olin McGowan was in Paris at the time and spoke to some of the people at the centre. So Olin, first of all, tell us about the centre itself and where it's housed in Paris.
Well, the location is unbeatable at 5 Rue des Irlandais, which I think was actually subsequently named Rue des Irlandais, near Jardin de Luxembourg and the magnificent Pantheon building. This is south of the river in the Latin Quarter, very, very central, stunning location. It's housed in the former Irish College in Paris, which was used as a seminary dating all the way back to 1578, but it kind of came under the control of the Irish cultural bodies in 1997, and in 2000 the Irish government announced funding to convert it to a cultural centre, which was inaugurated 20 years ago in 2002. So nearly 400 artists have spent time in the centre over the years, and it's become a real, I suppose, benchmark for cultural centres across Europe. The director of the centre is Nora Hickey, and I spoke to her really about the mission of the centre.
We showcase Irish art, so we present work year-round. We also host artists in residence, so we started in the early days with maybe 3 a year, and now we have about 40 artists coming to us every year. In the most recent call-out for artists, 800 applied, so there's huge demand. We're a place of creation and production. We commission new work. And a lot of the work that's created here by artists, of course, goes back to Ireland, is presented on stages in Ireland and around the world. To be honest, we've actually been celebrating for the full year. We've just come out of a really successful Joyce season. And we've chosen this date of the 16th of September. It's our launch date for our autumn season. The actual date we will be marking with an event, it's the 18th of October. And we'll be launching a series of podcasts created by Emmanuel Tellier, the French journalist.
And that's Nora Hickey there, director of the Irish Cultural Centre in Paris, speaking with Olin McGowan. Olin, it's clearly from what Nora's saying there, we get a real sense that there's constant throughput, a lot of stuff happening all the time. What are they doing at the moment then? What artists did you meet when you were there?
There's always artists to meet there, thankfully, But when I was there, first of all, the centre, the building is a beautiful, beautiful location. It's a square centre around this gorgeous courtyard. But on one of the wings of the building is a beautiful exhibition centre, very, very large room exhibition centre. An Irish artist, Aideen Barry, who we actually had on the show earlier this year, but she's presenting a large-scale film piece in the exhibition. It's entitled Oblivion in English, but it has an Inuit translation, which she'll elaborate on. That translation is central to the meaning of the exhibition, which I spoke to her about here.
So in English it's called Oblivion, Osgoelga it's called Shokmaltot, and in Inuktitut, or Inuit language, it's called Kwailutuk. So it's kind of a glottal kind of sound. I'm probably murdering it, so my apologies.
So, we're looking at a big screen here. There's a little bit of sound effects / music beginning to come up underneath us, and describe what we're seeing here.
So you're hearing a language that none of us would be very familiar with in the Western world. You're hearing Inuktitut, which is an Inuit language, a spoken word, and you're hearing this atmospheric kind of sound score, which is a stretched sound of harp playing in the background.
Isuanut Tikiluktuta.
And the music composition came from a few people, isn't that right?
Yeah, it did. Initially, actually, it was a commission by the ITMA, the Irish Traditional Music Archive and Music Network, to respond to the Bunting scores. So this young fella, a 19-year-old called Edward Bunting, in 1796, saved the Irish harp from oblivion. He wrote down the last remaining Lilson airs of Irish harp. And we have in the gallery space, you'll see a manifestation of his original writings. And we took one of the scores, The Lamentations of Owen Roe O'Neill by Turlough O'Carolan, and we reconfigured it for a kind of a gothic anthem that talks about being the last generation of artists.
Okay. And tell me about what we're seeing visually on this enormous screen, and it's very dark in here.
At the moment it's quite dark, but it's about to, I guess it's a bit like The Wizard of Oz, it's about to go from quite dark into this technicolour universe. But you're going to see lots of poison landscapes, the bowels of Ireland deep in Alloway Caves, harpists playing, throat singers calling to arms, and this kind of gothic anthem that's going to be a bit of a banger of a tune, banging out in the gallery space.
Okay. So,
what I'm trying to say with this entire installation and artwork is it's asking a question of you, the viewer, and it's asking a question of we, the artists, and that's my collaborating artists, Aisling Lyons-Wheat, Steve Shannell, Cathal Murphy, and Margaret O'Connor. What if we are the last generation of artists? What if the apocalypse is coming? How do you cope with that? How do you consider that? And how do you then manifest that through art as a kind of a language talking about the end of the world?
Dana Nunavut.
Now, you exhibited here 20 years ago. When you were, I mean, now you're an established artist, but you were by no means so at that stage.
No.
Tell me about your first experience being here.
It was 20 years ago. I was only a babogue. I was 22 at the time, 23. And I didn't ruin my reputation by being here. They actually invited me back, which is kind of astounding. But it was amazing. I was a single parent at the time. I was living on social welfare, and I had just a great champion, the previous director, Helen Carey. And she was trying to set this place up. She was trying to establish Irish culture and its place in the world, because Paris is really the capital of culture in the world, in terms of visual culture in particular. So she invited me out here, and I made my first piece, which was a commission for Bloomsday, for Ulysses' 80th anniversary at the time.
And we've just celebrated.
And we just celebrated the 100th, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that gives you the snapshot of it. And
a long-standing relationship.
I know. So when the wonderful Nora Hickey asked me to come back here again, I was like, yes, I would absolutely love to return. And I'm really honoured to be here. And it's a hopping place now. At the time, it was really trying to get, like, purchase in the world. But now, my God, it's such an established pinnacle of Irish culture and production, but in the world, merging world cultures. So it's a real honour to be here.
And that's artist Aideen Barry there speaking about her long relationship with the Irish Cultural Centre in Paris and her exhibition Oblivion, which is currently on show there as part of these 20th anniversary celebrations. And Olin, obviously you met with Aideen. Another artist with an ongoing relationship with the centre is Tom Moore of Cartoon Saloon, great Kilkenny animation company.
Yeah, long, long relationship. And we all know Cartoon Saloon for their animated features, The Secrets of Kells, Song of the Sea, The Breadwinner, and most recently, Wolfwalkers. Tom is one of the co-founders of Cartoon Saloon, and his relationship with the centre, as I said, goes way, way back. He's in Paris at the moment. He's researching for his next movie, but he spoke to me about his relationship with the centre.
Our very first film, we did some of the publicity for it here in the Irish Cultural Centre about 10 or 15 years ago, and since then each project that we've worked on we've had some link here to the Irish Cultural Centre. And I was lucky enough to be an artist in residence here last year when Wolfwalkers had its French release, and I was able to do some projects in conjunction with the Culture Centre, such as setting up a residency for Irish animators to be able to come here as well. So the links have gotten stronger over the 20 years, and I'm delighted to be in Arts in Residence again right now.
And Wolfwalkers obviously was dubbed into French, or rather the French voices put on top of it. Did you oversee that?
Yeah, no, it was a co-production. So we did part of the animation in France, and our composer was French, Bruno Coulet. And so there's a French dialogue director that's worked on all our films, and Jean-Marc, and he took care of it, and so basically he ran by me his choices for the cast and a few preliminary takes, and then pretty much I left him to it.
He had seen Muddy Wolfwalker. Ces êtres qui parlent avec les loups, avec ses pouvoirs magiques.
Tu peux sortir maintenant. On t'a repéré à l'odeur et tu en pestes. Vous êtes un wolfwalker?
So we worked with the Irish Culture Centre on coordinating the promotion while I was here. last year for the release of Wolfwalkers, and we had a special screening in conjunction with the Irish Culture Centre in Studio des Ursulines, which is a fantastic small cinema nearby.
A little clip there from Wolfwalkers, as I'm glad to hear it translates into in French. And that's Tom Moore of Cartoon Saloon speaking with Olin McGowan. He mentioned to you there, Olin, that he's researching another film at the moment in Paris. Did you find out any more about that?
Yeah, I think I remember this story. When he was in Paris last year, he was on his residency last year at the Cultural Centre, he came across an amazing story about a tiger that had escaped from a circus on the outskirts of Paris in 2017. And the tiger spent a day wandering around the streets of Paris before she was shot, unfortunately, near the Eiffel Tower. He was really inspired now when he read this story to come back, and he's researching the possibility of turning the story into a film, which we will definitely keep an eye out for.
Looking forward to that. That's Tom Moore of Cartoon Saloon, one of the 100 artists who continue to have an Irish, who continue to take part and be part of the lovely Irish Cultural Centre in Paris, celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. Full information on the centre on centreculturelirlandais.com, or just Google Irish Cultural Centre and it'll bring you there immediately. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. What could possibly come after Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, wrote Frederick Stock of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The glib answer was, of course, Beethoven's Sixth Symphony. But when you listen to that extraordinary piece and the impact of Beethoven's Fifth, it was astonishing that he could follow it up with such a gentle stroll in the park, stroll in the countryside symphony as the Sixth. The Pastoral Symphony, as it is called, is one of three pieces that will be performed by the National Symphony Orchestra this Thursday at Leisureland in Galway in a concert to celebrate 40 years of music for Galway. And of course, it's in the National Concert Hall the following night. Finnegan Collins nodding across the table at me. The concert will be there as well. They'll also be performing Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings, and the one that I really want to talk about initially to Finnegan Collins at any rate is Jean O'Leary's Unfolding Soundscapes for Piano and Orchestra. This, Finnegan, this Jean O'Leary piece is a special commission to celebrate this 40th anniversary, and I suppose it's a wonderful handing over the baton. There only have been two artistic directors of Music for Galway, Jean O'Leary and you.
Exactly, Sean, and that's why this idea came to me. And like a lot of good ideas, it's a very simple idea. I just thought, well, what could we? We'd love to commission a piece for our 40 years, and why don't we commission Jane, who is of course one of our most respected composers, one of our more senior composers now in the country. And she was, you know, basically founded Music for Galway along with a number of other like-minded people back in the 80s, and she ran it for 32 years. I took over then as artistic director in 2013, and steered the organisation through its 40th birthday last season. And I just thought, wouldn't it be nice to have the current artistic director performing a piece written by the previous artistic director.
And suitable that it should be on piano, given how Music for Galway actually started off. It was a piano, wasn't it?
Exactly. And also the fact that I'm a pianist and that Jane is also a pianist. So both artistic directors have been pianists. As you say, Music for Galway grew up around the desire to acquire a new instrument for Galway back in 1981, when really there was no instrument of any decent quality to be found in Galway. So the first thing that they did was to fundraise for a new piano, a new Steinway piano, which was inaugurated in the Isle of Maxima in University College Galway, as it was then, by John O'Connor, my teacher, of course. So that's how it started. They got a piano, and then they set about running and organising a series of concerts. And we've kept going.
That, as we have in this upcoming concert, as I said, the Beethoven Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral Symphony, and the Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings, and then this new piece from Jane, has that focus on kind of core repertoire and contemporary work, has that always been the dual mission, if you like, of Music for Galway?
Well, it has, and we've certainly tried, certainly during my time, we've tried to commission quite a number of new works and to play existing contemporary works. I mean, it would be, we would do less, if you look at the balance of music over the entire season, it wouldn't be 50-50 contemporary to non-contemporary, but we do think it's very important to present new work. We've done it over the last number of years, and we've co-commissioned a number of new pieces with other festivals abroad, notably cello concertos with the Cello Biennale of Amsterdam, and we do see it as a very important part of our remit to present contemporary music as well as the classics.
And I know, how do you describe a piece of music other than by playing it? Is it's a difficult task. Yeah. But what is Jane doing in this new piece, Unfolding Soundscapes? I suppose that kind of gives us a sense of it.
Yeah.
How would you describe the piece itself? It's for piano and orchestra, so it is a concerto style thing.
It is. Interestingly enough, she didn't want it to be known as a piano concerto. It's a piece for piano and orchestra. The piano is central to it also because of what we've just said about the piano being central to the history of the organisation. But it's not, I wouldn't say that the piano is a massively sort of muscular, percussive, hugely soloistic. It stands apart from the orchestra, but it's also sometimes melded into the orchestra. It comes into its own, I suppose, as the piece goes on. The piece is in three movements, each of about 5 minutes. It starts off sort of with this idea of searching for the piano, and quite, it's called With Quiet Persistence. So this is supposed to, the first movement is charting this search for the piano. The second movement is all about the organisation getting going and working, and the busy organising events and publicising them and in the office and all that sort of work going on in the second movement. And then the third movement is joyful. It's a celebration of where we've got to now, where the organisation has now got to, and a sense of joy and celebration of these 40 years.
Okay, it sounds like a wonderful journey in some ways from that quiet persistence through agitato perhaps into then the final movement, the joyous final movement. So that piece, it was, I suppose, in some ways it was an obvious choice and very important part of the organisation to celebrate in this anniversary concert. The choice then of Beethoven, and particularly the Sixth Symphony, was it lockdown and lots of walks in the countryside that put this in your mind?
Well, actually, we had a lot of discussions back and forth with the orchestras, what would suit them. Kenneth Montgomery, the conductor, what he might like to do. He's very well known for his Beethoven interpretations. But also Jane herself has often said that she has been very inspired by Beethoven. She's written works directly in response to Beethoven. So there is a real connection between Jane herself and Beethoven. So we really wanted a Beethoven symphony. And this pastoral is just so beautiful. Hadn't been done in Galway for a while. And so, you know, it's sort of a no-brainer, if you like. I think it'll provide a wonderful contrast to the work. Tchaikovsky, again, it's incredibly lyrical. It's incredibly beautiful. You know, you can't really beat Tchaikovsky's sense of melody and lyricism, and it's also its sense of classical structure. This is a piece that was said to be inspired by Mozart, by Tchaikovsky's enormous love for Mozart. Even the title Serenade harks back to Mozart's Serenades. It's the strings only, but boy, does he make use of the strings.
Yeah. Let's listen to part of the Tchaikovsky Serenade. This is the second movement, the wonderful the waltz.
Lovely.
Thank you.
A little flavour there of the waltz movement, the second movement from Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings, and that is one of the three pieces that will be performed by the National Symphony Orchestra at their upcoming concert in Galway. First of all, on Thursday the 6th of October at 8 p.m. In Leisureland, in association with Music for Galway, and subsequently then in the National Concert Hall on the Friday evening. Finian Collins, current director of Music for Galway, with me in studio this evening. When you look back at, you know, what was handed over to you, I suppose, in some ways from Jane, and then this piece, that unfolding soundscapes, is such a wonderful way of marking that. Where do you see, or where would you like to see the organisation going in from here forward, Finian?
Well, the organisation has taken big steps forward in the last 4 or 5 years, really thanks to the European Capital of Culture project. So we've really turned into an organisation which is much bigger than the one that it was, say, 9 or 10 years ago. More, you know, more going on, more staff, more events. And the cello festival Cellissimo that we've developed, which we presented online as part of the Galway 2020 experience, is something we want to continue with, and we're planning towards another edition of that in 2024, because we envisage it as a triennale. So that's something that's really added to the workload and to the offering that we're bringing. And you know, beyond that, just to continue with presenting our season, our Midwinter Festival, and all the great things that we do.
Well, listen, congratulations on that anniversary. I know it was delayed slightly because of COVID, but what wasn't delayed because of COVID?
Absolutely.
That's Finian Collins. Thanks for coming into us this evening, Finian. Celebrated concert marking 40 years since the foundation of Music Galway, Music for Galway. Thursday, October the 6th at 8 p.m. in Leisureland in Galway, the National Symphony Orchestra will be conducted by Kenneth Montgomery, Finian Collins on piano, performing the world premiere of Jane O'Leary's Unfolding Landscapes. Musicforgalway.ie for full details. And just as we finish, sad news today, the death was announced of country singer Loretta Lynn, aged 90, originally from Kentucky, came from humble beginnings, one of 8 children to a coal mining family. She wrote about her upbringing in a song called The Coal Miner's Daughter in 1970, which is the title also of her autobiography. Turned into a biopic featuring Sissy Spacek. Many awards, prestigious Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civil award given to her by Barack Obama in 2013. And I'm a Honky Tonk Girl, Whispering Sea, Blue Kentucky Girl, and of course this song, one of our big hits from 1970. Your holler. We were poor but we had love. That's the one thing that Daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal to make a poor man's dollar. My daddy worked all night in the Van Leer coal mines. All day long in the field of hoeing corn. There we go, Loretta Lynn, whose death has been announced. She was 90 years old. I'm sure John Creedon will have more of Loretta Lynn to share with you coming up after the news.